This is The Think Tank, talking about the major political, economic, and social issues of the week. With Dr. Mike O'Neill and hosted by Mike Russell. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com. The Think Tank.
Well, the intro is at least half true. Mike O'Neill here. Mike Russell has, some say he's gone fishing, but I saw him in the other studio taping another show. Light staffing for the summer here. Okay, the Supreme Court has spoken, and it saves its very best cases or most significant cases traditionally for last. So we've had a flurry of really big decisions, important issues here. And we have with us on the Think Tank this week one of the most erudite observers of the court, Dean Paul Bender. If you want to understand what the court did or why, and I think you should, stick around. We're going to talk about, among other things, gay marriage, Obamacare, redistricting, fair housing, and possibly a couple of other issues. A short intro, a little longer than usual because his resume warrants it, just so you know the significance of who we're talking to. Paul Bender has himself argued more than 20 cases before the Supreme Court. He was the principal deputy solicitor general of the United States. Now, that's a mouthful, but my layman's understanding is that the solicitor general is really the attorney for the federal government. The attorney general runs the Justice Department, but the solicitor general is really the government's lawyer. Fair statement?
Yeah, government's appellate lawyer, yep. Yeah.
Okay. Well, he was also, and this is back to Supreme Court experience, a law clerk for U.S. Supreme Court Justice Felix Frankfurter, and that suggests to me you've been around for a while. He was appointed by Franklin Roosevelt. He was also a law clerk to Appeals Court Judge Learned Hand. And according to my research, he is quoted by some as the most cited judge ever. He was dean of the ASU College of Law and was a faculty at Penn for 24 years. Welcome to the show.
Good to be here.
Well, number one, gay marriage, we don't need to reiterate what that decision said, but I want to use that as a springboard to talk about kind of the intersection of kind of culture and law. My understanding that a lot of this is based on the 14th Amendment notion that we should have equal protection of the laws.
That's not what the opinion in the gay marriage case is based on.
Okay, elaborate then.
It's based on the right to marry.
Uh-huh.
There's a little bit of a mention of equal protection at the end, which is very confusing to me, but the whole opinion, almost all of the opinion, and clearly the most important ground for Kennedy was a right to marry, which he thinks was being unconstitutionally denied. That right also comes from the 14th Amendment.
Well, let me ask you about one aspect of that, because I am convinced that, say, had this case come up 50 years ago, or maybe 20 years ago, or maybe 10, I doubt that the outcome would have been the same, even though the law on which it's based is the same. And my suggestion would be there's a sort of a, if this came up 50 years ago, that there's a high likelihood that the court would have just dismissed it as absurd.
They never would have taken it.
Yeah.
The court has complete discretion.
And so
what it takes.
The question I'd like you to elaborate is that we say that the justices claim to be just sort of reading the law and imputing from that an answer. But in reality, our social culture belief system plays a role in that, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, it plays a role in everything. But the judges don't say that. All they look at is the words of the Constitution. That's clearly not true. The words of the Constitution don't help you very much, even whether you treat the gay marriage case as a right to marry case or as an equal protection case, because the words are very vague. No state shall deny anyone life, liberty, or property without due process of law, and no state shall deny the equal protection of the laws to anybody in the state. So that doesn't decide the case, but there have been a lot of cases since that language was adopted into the 14th Amendment that the court, all the justices will look at. There's a tremendous amount of law that's built up there. And, for example, there's a big structure about the Equal Protection Clause, where suspect classifications get one kind of treatment by the court, non-suspect classifications get another. There's an intermediate suspect classification category. It gets really complicated.
Might want to explain what a suspect classification is.
The court says says all classifications, all inequalities of treatment are not the same. Some are worse than others. And it started by saying that things based on race are immediately suspect and can only be justified if there's pressing public necessity. Now they would say compelling interest. They mean the same thing. So if you have a racial classification, the court treats that one way. But if you have a classification between doctors and lawyers, for example, or small, tall people and short people, or people who do well on a test and people who don't do well on a test, the court treats that not as suspect, but as presumptively constitutional. And you have to show basically that it's completely irrational in order to be constitutional. So there's a wide variance in treatment of classifications depending upon whether the court thinks they're suspect or not. And the same thing's true with liberty. Liberty is protected, says the court, by the Due Process Clause, but not all liberty is protected equally. The current structure is that fundamental liberty is protected more than your right to drive as fast as you want on the highway. That's liberty, but it's not fundamental. But the fundamental liberty of being able to have an abortion, for example, or being able to use contraceptives, that fundamental liberty can only be interfered with if the government has a compelling interest. If it's liberty but not a fundamental one, then all they need is a good reason.
Now, back to this particular case, I'm thinking there's, over the country, thousands and thousands of laws that, for example, distinguish between husband and wife rather than just married partners. Are we setting up for a mass amount of future litigation based on this case as the sort of the laws, the way they're written, no longer comport to this decision?
Yeah, I don't think so. There will be some litigation. That is, some statutes will be written of a man and a wife who are married can adopt a child, say. And somebody will say, well, two men married can't adopt a child because this is a man and a wife who are married. That won't work. It shouldn't work. It can't work. If the court means that there's a constitutional right to marry, then you can't say, well, you're married, but nothing that goes along with marriage goes along with it with you. You have to give gay couples all the rights of heterosexual couples.
That would seem to...
The fact that a statute talks about a man and a woman or a husband and wife is not going to change that.
I can't see that winning, but I can see some people who are holding out. For example, the governor of Texas says you don't have to issue these licenses yet.
Well, that's a different problem.
Mm-hmm.
There is a delay. Court decisions are not immediately enforceable because you give people a chance to file a petition for rehearing. But more importantly, if the case doesn't involve you as a party, the fact that the case says something about what you do doesn't mean that you have to do it under penalty of contempt. Somebody's got to sue you and get a judgment against you, and then you have to do it under penalty of contempt. So if people want to resist this, they can just say, sue me.
And that's, I guess, what I'm sort of anticipating, that there are going to be, in enclaves in this country, there's going to be elected officials and others who don't like this and will drag their feet. I mean, I see this as analogous, for example, to Brown v. Board with school desegregation. That took 15 years to get implemented.
I hope it's not analogous to that. I agree with you. There will be some resistance. You can't tell how much. There have been glimmers of that. You mentioned one from Texas. I think there are other states. Yeah. Even here in Arizona, the Maricopa County attorney said after gay marriage became legal here because of a Ninth Circuit decision that he was not going to treat gay couples the same way he treats heterosexual couples with regard to advice he gives and help he gives to couples who are adopting children.
Well, that sounds like litigation waiting to happen. We will be back with Dean Paul Bender. We'll talk about the Redistricting Commission. We will talk about Obamacare and other issues when we return right now on The Think Tank.
The Think Tank. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay, redistricting, another case held by the Supreme Court. In this case, it was an Arizona case, and it said the Independent Redistricting Commission, which was established by the voters in 2000, is a constitutional remedy that the people can implement. Is that a fair statement?
Except Yes, except the only issue was whether they could redistrict congressional districts. There was no challenge in that case to the commission's ability to redistrict state legislative districts, because the basis of that case was a provision of the federal constitution, which talks about the time, place, and manner of federal elections. So this case only involved the 9 congressional districts in Arizona.
So now the redistricting commission is settled law. Is that fair?
Well, the redistricting commission's the constitutionality of it drawing congressional districts is settled, but that doesn't mean that there couldn't be challenges to particular districts that are drawn. There are legal standards. For example, the districts have to have equal numbers of people in them.
Well,
one vote rule.
In that case, there is a case that the court has already agreed to hear for next year.
Right.
On the subject of redistricting, can you elaborate on how that is distinct from what was settled here?
Yeah, I'm not as familiar with that case as I should be, but I think I know the basic difference. That case involves an application of the one-person, one-vote rule. The Supreme Court decided years ago that districts, legislative districts, both state and federal, had to have basically the same number of people in them. You're allowed small variations. The issue in that case is the challenge is made that the state districts here are not sufficiently equal in population. The variations in population are too big. And if the variations of population are constitutionally too big, then those districts would have to be withdrawn to equalize the number of people in them. That doesn't take a lot of change. That is unlikely to change who is going to win elections in those districts, because you just have to move a couple of thousand people from one district to another. And unless the district is very, very, very closely divided, that's probably not going to change the result. So that's a completely different issue. It's about the state legislative districts, and it's about one person, one vote. It's about numerical equality. Whereas the case the court just decided says that the Independent Redistricting Commission in this state and in other states, and other states are beginning to do this, has the constitutional authority to draw congressional districts.
Now, is this case, this upcoming case, restricted entirely to the number of people? I thought it had a component in it having to do with racial gerrymandering.
There may be. I had heard that. I'm not sure of that. If there is, there are rules against racial gerrymandering, unless you have a really good reason to draw lines according to race. I've also heard rumors of people saying it involves the claim that the commission was biased toward Democrats. That is not a plausible constitutional claim, although it probably should be. But the Supreme Court said several times, several years ago, that political gerrymandering is not unconstitutional the way racial gerrymandering would be. So I'm not sure how powerful a claim they would have that the commission favored one party or another. That may be in the case, but I think the primary issue is the numerical equality.
And in any event, it seems to me that this case is relatively small compared to the one that was just passed on was big. That was about whether or not to basically blow up the entire commission.
No, only with regard to its drawing of congressional. And, you know, they draw the state legislative districts also. If the Supreme Court had ruled against the commission a couple of days ago, it still would have had full authority to draw state legislative districts.
But the congressional drawing would have gone back to the legislature.
The legislature would have called a special session. The governor would have called a special session. Almost immediately, I think, they already had the maps drawn, and they would have passed new districting that was favorable to the Republicans. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I want to move on to Obamacare. Now, obviously, I don't want to relitigate what's well known. It basically was a second bite at the apple. I looked at this, however, and as a layman, it says that this is a 2,000-page statute, and this was all about one word in one paragraph where they said state exchanges instead of state or federal exchanges. But the most astounding thing to me was how 4 justices could actually claim, in the absence of clear intent, which I thought was very clear, that they were trying to establish state and federal exchanges to give everybody an opportunity for subsidized health care if they qualified. And nobody ever claimed that the intent was anything else. They just sort of hung on. There's one word and one phrase in a 2,000-page document.
Well, it was 4 words, but basically what you're saying is right, except it wasn't 4 justices, it was only 3. Chief Justice Roberts joined with the liberals and Justice Kennedy in that case. It's only Alito and Scalia and Thomas who took that position, so, that those words should be given their what they call literal effect, even though it would totally destroy the purpose of the statute. But it's even worse than that, because everybody says, and they said it in their dissenting opinion, I think, that the statute said the only people who are qualified to get subsidies are people who are on state exchanges. It doesn't say that. It says the people who are qualified to get subsidies are people whose income level is below a certain amount. Then in saying how the subsidy amount is calculated, it refers to people who have their insurance through a state exchange. It's just a reference. It's not in the statute stated as a qualification. So it's even weaker than that. And clearly what happened was the statute went through a lot of changes. And when it started, they assumed that the only exchanges were going to be state exchanges and all the states would have them. But as time went on, it became clear that some states would not. And so they changed it to say, okay, if the state doesn't have one, the federal government will do the exchange we thought the state was going to do. But they didn't go back through the whole statute and change all the references to exchanges.
Okay, bottom line, we're coming up on a hard break. Is Obamacare settled law here at this point?
Yeah, more or less. But you can challenge anything, and I'm sure there will be some losses. But the main body of it is settled.
Okay, we will be back with Dean Paul Bender. We will discuss several other issues that were up before the Supreme Court this year. Back in the Think Tank in just a minute.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We are back in the Think Tank with Dean Paul Bender. We've discussed the Supreme Court cases on gay marriage, on independent redistricting, a very big deal in Arizona. It was an Arizona case. We've discussed Obamacare. Want to move on. Fair housing case, going back all the way to a 1968 Fair Housing Act. Wow. Seemed like it shouldn't have taken 50 years to litigate that.
It didn't. It was pretty well settled. The court took that case with the possibility of overturning a whole bunch of lower court decisions which said a certain thing, and the people were afraid the court was going to overturn it. It didn't. By 5-4, it kept the rule the way it was. The issue is whether disparate impact is significant under the Fair Housing Act. That is, if somebody who owns property and is renting it has a rule about who will rent to, which has a disparate impact upon black tenants because of the rule. A lot more black people can't pass the rule than white people. The question is that kind of rule a violation of the Housing Act, or does the Housing Act only apply when it's a deliberate attempt to keep racial minorities out? And the court, years ago, the courts have decided, this comes up under all kinds of discrimination statutes, like Title VII, discrimination in employment, and discrimination in places of public accommodation. The courts generally have decided that disparate impact is illegal. Not always. You have to justify it, but it has significance under the statutes. And the court took this case to consider whether that continued to be the rule under the Fair Housing Act. And by the breath of one vote, the court decided to keep it the way it was.
Let me, let me give you a layman's interpretation of that and tell me if I have it right.
Yeah.
If I have a housing development and I got a memo somewhere that says we don't want any blacks to live here, we're gonna keep them out. That's a smoking gun, and nobody was questioning whether or not that's discrimination. But by disparate impact, what I think it means is, if there is no smoking gun, but I'm in an area that's half white and half black, and we've never had a black resident here,
it's not that.
Okay.
Suppose you said, I won't rent you a apartment unless you have a high school diploma. And half as large a percentage of black people have high school diplomas as white people. That would have a disparate impact. on black people who are trying to get apartments. It's a rule has a disparate impact. It's not just that, well, I think he's discriminating.
Okay.
You'd have to show some reason for the discrimination.
So, for example, if I'm hiring somebody for a job requiring a college degree, that's okay because it's likely relevant.
Well, if something has a disparate impact, say in employment, if you do something that has a disparate impact upon women, you can do it, but you have to have a strong business necessity for doing it. You can't just do it because you want to.
Say, for example, I'm UPS and I need people to lift 50-pound packages. Okay, there's going to be more women who aren't able to do that. That may be okay.
That may be okay, right. So here it's the same kind of thing. If you have things that you say the tenants have to qualify for, and that has a disparate impact upon racial minorities, the court held, as courts had held for all those years, that is a problem, and you have to have a strong justification for that. So the court didn't change anything. But what was important here was that four members of the court wanted to change it. If you turn those civil rights statutes into statutes where you can only win if you can prove conscious, purposeful discrimination by the employer or the landlord or whoever, that makes those statutes very, very much weaker.
Almost always, incredibly difficult to prove if that's the standard.
Right. And four members of the court said you ought to overrule those old cases. They were wrong. Discrimination, even under statutes, is not illegal unless it's purposeful discrimination. Thomas and Alito and Roberts and Scalia voted for that, and that would have been an enormous change. That, to me, that is probably the most important case that the court decided this year that shows that the court has really become somewhat more liberal. I don't think 10 years ago the court would have done that. That seems to me to be changing some. The court last year, if you look at the cases you think are most important, almost all of them came out in a liberal direction, which is something that hasn't happened for a long time. And if you look at Justice Kennedy, who's thought to be the swing vote, he used to join with the conservatives about twice as often as he did with the liberals. This term, he joined the liberals twice as often as he joined the conservatives. And if that continues, the court will have moved from a really conservative court to a moderate court.
Well, in fact, that was what I was going to close with you on question. I had seven cases listed here that we're not going to get to all of them, but the seven sort of what I call the biggest cases at the end, by my count, five out of seven went in a liberal direction. Now, we had you on the show maybe about a year ago, and I recall you saying something like, this court is moving in a sort of radically conservative direction. It seems to me that you're detecting a real change. Something like that. I wonder if you still think that, or did I don't think I misquoted, but...
I don't think I said they were moving in it. I may have said that they are a very conservative court, which they were, because they have four really conservative people, and Justice Kennedy, who, as I said, joins with them twice as often as he joined the liberals. But that seems to be changing, because this term he joined with the liberals twice as much as he joined with the conservatives, and that makes all the difference. The case we were just talking about is 5-4 with Kennedy in the majority. The gay rights case is 5-4 with Kennedy in majority. The Arizona State Legislature case is 5-4 with Kennedy in the majority. That's what's happening. Kennedy's votes in this term, anyway, have sided with the liberals more often than in the past. Whether that will continue or not depends on what Kennedy does.
Well, here's my question about that. Do you think Kennedy is evolving personally, or do you think that it's the nature of the particular cases that happen to hit in front of the case, in front of the court this year?
Either is possible, and I obviously don't know, but I think there has been some evolution. And I think this is total speculation, that the evolution is coming because he has become the leader on the court in establishing gay rights. And he has gotten a lot of notoriety for that, and I think he has a lot of satisfaction for that. And seeing that you can bring rights to people who didn't have rights before, and that you feel good about it and the country feels good about it, I think encourages you to think about doing the same kind of thing in other areas.
I think that was evident in the opinion that he wrote on that case, isn't it? I mean, it was really broad, sweeping history of marriage and history of rights.
It did, but it was a lot of history, but it, to me, what was important about it was so heartfelt. You read that opinion and you know that he cares, and you, he tells you why he cares. And if you develop that kind of empathy with groups, which he has certainly with gay people, I think it flops over into other areas. And so his positions on race-conscious affirmative action, for example, have softened some. He used to be absolutely against it. That's changed. In part, it's because of the thing I just said. Another reason, I think, is because the people on the right, the really conservative people, drive him away. Robert said something about racial segregation a couple of years ago that Kennedy, even though he agreed with Roberts in the case, said, You're wrong. You can't say that. That's just not true. It Scalia drives people away with some of the outrageous things he says. So that may be at work also.
The other, I guess, and since Roberts is not always the predictable conservative as well.
Not always, just 99% of it. Roberts has been on the court for 10 years. In how many cases do you think he's voted with the liberals where his vote made a difference? He's voted with the conservatives, the case would come out differently. In 10 years.
Probably not very many.
Twice.
The Obama case.
Not this one.
The first one.
The first Obama case. And that, most of that opinion was conservative rather than liberal. And this year he did one involving whether judges had a right to raise money when they're running for election from people face-to-face or whether they had to use the committee. And the court said that it was okay to make them use the committee. And he joined with the liberals to say that. That's the only real case in 10 years that he joined with liberals where his vote made a difference. So it's Kennedy who is moving, if anybody's moving. It's not Roberts.
So put that all together. Take a look at, you know, you've been observing the court about as closely as anyone. Do you see the court really evolving in a less conservative direction?
A little bit. As far as Kennedy will let it go, there's nobody on the court who is as staunch a liberal as William Brennan, for example, or Thurgood Marshall, or Earl Warren, the people who controlled the court's thinking some years ago. There's nobody like that. What you have is moderate liberals and Kennedy. So they're not going to do anything dramatically liberal, but the court can evolve into being a more moderate court and doing less changes in the conservative direction if Kennedy is moderating his views, which I think he is.
It'll be certainly interesting to watch. I did want to get, but we got into this sort of global question of the direction of the court, but there was one other case that had a little bit of an Arizona component, and that is the death penalty case.
More than a little.
Well, I mean, we had a botched execution.
Well, no, we used the same drug as was involved in that case. If those executions have been held to be unconstitutional, Arizona's executions would be equally unconstitutional. We do exactly what Oklahoma did, but the court sustained what we're doing by a 5-4 vote.
Let me ask you, I look at the people who are raising these cases. Part of it seems a little disingenuous to me in that it seems to me their real agenda is they're against the death penalty and they're going to oppose it in any way. Not unlike the people who are anti-abortion on the other side are trying to come up with any, they'd like to overrule Roe versus Wade, but they can't do it. So they're going to restrict as much as they can.
If you're saying that there are people on the court who have that kind of attitude toward the death penalty, that they really want to get rid of it, I don't think there are many. There may be
The litigants I'm talking about, the people who bring the case against
the
drug.
But the court does not have a majority that wants to get rid of the death penalty.
I think two people came out.
Breyer and Ginsburg. Breyer wrote an opinion saying we ought to think about it, and here's why. And he wrote a long explanation of why he thought that the reasons that the court reinstituted the death penalty in the late 70s by saying that you had to have standards for giving it. You couldn't just give it arbitrarily. Breyer says the hope was that that would work and the standards would make the application of the death penalty be more rational. But he said, you know, it hasn't worked. Everybody knows it hasn't worked. So it's time, he said, to reconsider whether, given the fact that it works in such an arbitrary way, that we ought to continue to have the death penalty. But there's only two people on the court who might take that view right now.
So that one's going no way. But I was raising the question of people who are raising this case about this particular drug cocktail. Had the court come down differently on this one, they would have outlawed this particular recipe, but they would have come up with another one.
I mean, one of the startling things about Alito's opinion in this case is he basically says you have to have the death penalty. If what the government is using is cruel and unusual punishment, it's up to you, the person who's about to be executed, to come up with a better method, a more humane method. And if you can, you'll get executed by the method they're using, even if it is inhumane, because the bottom line, he says, is that there has to be a death penalty. That's remarkable to me that four people on the court would sign on to that.
Bottom line is you don't see the Supreme Court outlawing the death penalty anytime in the foreseeable future. And if the death penalty is going to be restricted, it's going to be at the state level, I presume.
Right. And you know some states are considering. A lot of states have already said they're not going to do it. Nebraska just said they weren't going to do it. I don't think the Supreme Court is going to say the death penalty is always cruel and unusual punishment in the foreseeable future.
Well, thank you very much. We've covered a lot of ground here, and I very much appreciate your joining us here on the Think Tank, and hope we can get you back again sometime in the future. Thank you.
You're welcome. Nice to talk to you, Mike.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay. Our thanks to Paul Bender, former Dean ASU Law School, and a longtime Supreme Court watcher and participant at many levels. The big surprise of the interview was that while we dealt with gay marriage, we dealt with Obamacare, we dealt with redistricting, I was struck by Dean Bender's comment that he thought the most significant case of all that the court dealt with was one that hasn't gotten a lot of press, and that was the fair housing case. And let me sort of give you my rationale for why I think that he saw that as important. Discrimination is a long-term problem in this country, but proving it is very, very difficult often. And what this court said is, nobody questioned the basic standard. If you prove there's a memo that says we're not going to admit any Hispanics to live in this housing complex, that's discrimination, and the law is going to sanction that. But let's say you set up some rule, and the one he cited is, oh, you must have a high school degree to live here. Or you set up some other arbitrary rule, and that rule has nothing to do with what you're admitting people for. Say it's not for a job, it's for housing, where I think arguably having a high school degree has nothing to do with your suitability as a tenant. But let's say there's half as many Hispanics or half as many blacks with a high school degree. And what this case said is, if that rule, which is arbitrary, has what the legal term is, quote, disparate impact. In other words, it impacts some groups more than others. And those groups are groups that are suspect. And suspect groups are groups that have historically been discriminated against. So the law looks at them separately and says, now let's make sure that what's going on doesn't hurt those groups in particular. You know, as he pointed out, there's other groups that are not suspect, short people or, you know, you name it, red-haired people, who are not historically discriminated against. And so while you can raise a case about that, it's not suspect from the get-go. And I think the reason he saw that is important is if you took away the disparate impact qualification, then basically almost all of these discrimination suits go away, and most of them are potentially are cases where there is overwhelming evidence that there is discrimination going on. There is a rule that's arbitrary and has nothing to do with what you're really trying to accomplish, and the underlying purpose is really, for example, racial or gender discrimination. So my big takeaway is he thought that was the most important case, and in the context of some other very, very important cases. Gay marriage is obviously historic. My interesting observation about that one is that, the law in that area hasn't changed. What's changed is culture. In the last 5 years, the number of people who have come out of the closet has, I think, convinced most Americans that that being gay is not just this foreign San Francisco crazy kind of thing. It is our friends, our neighbors, our sons, our daughters. And basically, it's normal. It's within a normal range of things that occur. And increasingly, the belief it's something that you're born with. And if that's the case, then while some may not like it, and a lot of people say, well, I would never do it, I don't, I cannot see the legitimacy in prohibiting others from doing so. The public opinion on that, last poll I saw was about 57% in favor of. My personal guess, when you do, you come back in another month or two, my guess is it's 67%, because when a court comes down and makes a definitive case like this, it not only reflects culture, I think it changes culture. Independent redistricting, the hands of drawing the lines on legislative districts is no longer going to be in the hands of those who have a vested interest. And I think that is pretty much settled law now. Now, there's questions that will be before the court next time about how the choices were made in a particular case. Those are fair game. But the legitimacy of this commission in order to actually draw these lines is no longer questioned. So momentous decisions here. Interestingly, in a court that most see as heavily conservative, the majority of this court is Republican appointed and were chosen to be very conservative. But by my count, there were seven major cases handled by the court here. Five out of seven came down in what one might call a quote liberal dimension. Now, of course, some of that could be the nature of the cases that actually came in front of the court, but likely it reflects the fact also that, Dean Bender pointed out, Justice Kennedy may be evolving. He may be actually alienated by some of his others. Okay, we will handle next week. John Hsu, former White House attorney, will discuss with us the upcoming cases. There are some blockbusters that we will have in front of us next year. We're not done.